Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show this week. Our sponsors this week are Environments for Humans, who are doing the CSS Summit at csssummit.com, an online conference, their fifth annual one. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later. And Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com/shoptalk. Use the coupon code SHOPTALK4 for a discount there. We'll tell you about that more later in the show, too. But for now, let's kick things off. Shop Talk Show, a sound effects podcast all about web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody, and with us this week, white space strategist from Opera Software, Mike Taylor. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Mike Taylor, Opera. We are big fans of Opera here at the show.
I know Dave is a personal huge fan.
Mm-hmm. I am just beaming.
Ecstatic is the word you're looking for.
Opera pride.
That's right.
Dude, I died laughing earlier looking at Oprah Mobile. Oprah has a mobile site. Oprah.com/Oprah. It's Oprah.com/Oprah.com spelled out. /Oprah-mobile-web-site. Anyway, it's the best URL ever. It's nothing to do with that.
Some of our best work.
Dude.
Oprah Mobile. That's a Austin, job, too, right?
Yeah. I've been living in Austin for, I guess, close to a year and a half. Moved here from Brooklyn. And
yeah. It still says Brooklyn on Skype.
Oops. Yeah, I don't really use Skype.
Yeah,
it's not your preferred social network. That's awkward because they sure the way they design it makes it feel like it wants to be a social network. But
Mike Taylor without an e.com, it's kind of an advanced website.
Yeah, it's great. I love it.
Pushing some boundaries.
I work on it every day. You can tell.
Well, what do you actually do, though? You can tell us that, right? A little, like you know.
What do I do at Opera?
Yeah, at Opera, yeah.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I really don't know how to answer that question. So technically, yeah. I'm on...
That's why I asked, because I don't understand.
Technically, I'm on the web standards team at Opera. It was a team that was organized a couple months ago after the big shakeup. I used to be on the developer relations team, but now I'm part of the web standards team. I don't know that I have a job title, but what I actually do is, for the past couple of months, I've been, working on the desktop team, helping out the DevTools guys and working on the next version of Opera desktop. So,
yeah, right on.
Yeah. Writing code and breaking browsers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of a good guy to have around. Maybe that should be your title.
Good guy to have around.
I think I first met you through, I was like a jQuery conference way back.
I think I went up and introduced myself because I had purchased your WordPress book once upon a time and made a few few dollars, and that saved my bacon. So I went and said, thanks for your book.
Oh, nice. Really? I remember because you spoke at it. I can't even remember.
I did speak at it, but that was kind of like my in to talk to such a huge celebrity such as Chris Coyer.
Oh, I was the dumbest guy in the room at that. That was like 3 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, then we talked later about because you're like the one thing that really is at miketaylor.com is like some support charts for HTML5 input stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to copy you, kind of, because I wanted to do it too, because I was working at Wufoo at the time, which was heavily invested in forms, and we needed to make sure we were doing all the right stuff. So I kind of launched upon my own research and kind of had you look at it and stuff. So, Yeah, I don't know. Do you still? I mean, I don't know how up to date you keep those things.
I don't ever touch it. I mean, yeah.
Right. It's less interesting these days. Although it's still, you know, well, you know, it'll be like, I don't know, you know, Firefox 32 is out or whatever, and it has slightly different support for these things. It is still kind of a changing target.
It is. I guess it could make sense to update some of the stuff, like some of the pseudo whatever attributes that have been added, but. Yeah, I'm kind of really lazy, so that's not going to happen.
Right. I don't know if it'd be nice if maybe we can just leave that kind of work to Can I Use or whatever.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Cool. So what else do you got? Do you got anything, Dave? That's pretty light on the drama this week.
Well, yeah, the only, I guess, piece of drama that I could think of was that Chrome or the W3C via Chrome's suggestion, they added in the EME spec, the encrypted media extension, aka DRM.
DRM for content or whatever?
Yeah, pretty much video. So.
Oh, video. Okay. Somebody, yeah. I saw some tweet the other day that they were like, oh, they're moving forward with like any kind of content, DRM, textual.
Oh,
content.
I mean, I guess that could be true. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how it works.
Yeah, I think I saw some tweet from Charles McCaffrey Neville, who's at Yandex, and it mentioned something about someone wanting to DRM their really awesome JavaScript code. I couldn't tell if that was sarcasm or what.
It is hard some days.
I mean, people want to do that. I think somebody does, you know, but at the same time, it's like, DRM JavaScript, and also steal all your data. Done.
So maybe we should do a few minutes on, because Mike, the name came up from Dave when the Blink and Opera switching to WebKit kind of stuff went down. We're like, we should get Mike on to tell us all about this.
Because we kind of just lie. We just say things we've heard, Mike. And so.
Kind of. And I don't know if that we've ever given it any proper airtime. And I know maybe this is like old news now, but it's probably worth talking about a little bit. It actually might be more interesting now that things have shaked out a little bit. So the news came that Opera was switching to WebKit first. And then shortly afterwards, the Chrome said, hey, we're forking that and we're going to do Blink instead of WebKit or whatever. And then it was like, oh, so. Just in the timeline of events, you knew about Blink first, right? Because
so, let's go back one previous step to that. So I think it was about a year ago. I was sitting at the Ginger Man, which is a bar in Austin, with Dave, and he was kind of complaining to me, and he said, "Man, why doesn't Opera just switch to WebKit?" This is a true story.
I really want to believe that Dave.
So naturally, I sent a few emails out. Those went straight to spam. Mm-hmm. But So we're still waiting on his H.264 request. I think that's the only other thing he complains to me about.
That's the biggest one. But I'm hoping. So do I get a Webby because of this, or do I get any sort of?
Go talk to your friend Jeffrey Zeldman. Does he do Webbies?
I think so. Yeah, possibly. And do I get maybe some Norwegian flat pack furniture?
I've got some licorice in the shape of a Viking ship. If you want to come down to the east side and pick it up this afternoon.
Maybe like a really uncomfortable couch.
This is great.
A sauna.
Okay. So
after my catalyst.
So after Dave made that happen. So we announced we were switching to WebKit. I think the reasons have been pretty well enumerated by Bruce Lawson on his blog, and maybe there were some Opera blogs that explained it, why we were making the change. I think, you know, it was kind of a bummer for me personally. I think Presto is actually a pretty awesome rendering engine. But there's lots of reasons why switching to Chromium makes sense. You know, it frees up a lot of engineering effort. You don't have to do so much catch up with Google, who moves at warp speed. Also, there's tons of compatibility wins. You know, you don't have to deal with the legacy of super old Netscape 4 scripts blocking Opera users. And then I actually didn't find out about Blink until the day before the announcement.
Oh, wow.
But that's just because, like, I'm the white space strategist, right? Like, I'm the lowest guy on the totem pole. My boss, Largeric, a super cool guy, in case he's listening. So he had been informed by Google, you know, weeks before. And so, like, the important people knew about this change. But it wasn't something we knew about when we decided, okay, let's switch to Chromium.
Wow. So you didn't know. That's interesting. I thought you would have known long. And then in your kind of, maybe you even decided to do it because Blink is going to be so much cooler or better.
No, I'm pretty sure that's not the case. So I found out. The way I found out was Paul Irish. He sent me a message in IRC, and he said, "Hey, I know something. Do you know something?" And I was just like, "What? Like, am I getting fired? Like, did Facebook actually buy Opera? This sucks." And I said, "No." And then he said, "Oh, never mind. You know, I blew it. I should have been like, yeah, man, that's crazy." And waited for him to spill the beans.
Yeah.
So then I went and kind of started poking some people at Opera, and I said, like, "Yo, what's up?" And then I found out, oh, okay, this Blink thing's going to happen tomorrow, or it was in 2 days or something. And so, but. You know, it really hasn't affected the efforts of the next version of Opera desktop and mobile. I mean, our plans were to be based off of Chromium. And so Chromium has a dependency, or had a dependency, on WebKit, you know, and one day they flipped the switch and said, okay, we're Blink now, but that's still a dependency on Chromium.
Right. Yeah. And browsers are just more complicated than that in general, right? You still got to kind of bring your own networking layer, and the UI will still look like Opera.
Yeah, precisely. So it wasn't like holy crap, we got to start over Blink, right? It's kind of like a gradual process. Like, I don't even think Blink is actually in. Does anyone know what version Chrome is at stable?
I don't.
27. Yeah, 2X. I think Blink is actually Chrome version 28, so you might even still be using WebKit Chromium as if it actually mattered. Right now, there's very little difference other than, like, I think some metric was dropped that they've deleted, like, 16% of the code base. Chris, you asked a question about DevTools.
Yeah, is it going to be Dragonfly still, or is it going to be going to just start using Web Inspector or whatever they call it?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting. I'm interested in that question as well. Christian Krebs, he manages the DevTools team at Opera. You know, he asked me, he said, "Hey, do you want to help out on the DevTools team? Maybe work on the future of Dragonfly."
Yes,
and my
is that what you said?
Well, I said, "Oh, that would be neat, but I don't actually know JavaScript." I had to have, like, a little confession, right? So I'm still learning. But so the idea is to create a Dragonfly 2, right? It won't be the same thing that exists in Opera today, which is kind of sad because I personally think Dragonfly is awesome. I think it's, in a lot of ways, better than Chrome DevTools. But every browser has really cool stuff. But I think Dragonfly is great. As far as I understand, I mean, I can't commit to anything because I'm not, like, a boss, but it will be building on top of Chrome DevTools, extending it, refining it, porting in some of the stuff that existed in Opera Dragonfly.
Yeah, maybe you're, like, uniquely qualified to be cool, because if you use Dragonfly a lot and know what you like in it, and now you're kind of forced to switch over to Web Inspector or whatever.
Yeah.
So all the things that you miss that bug you now, you can port over.
Precisely. And, you know, and any improvements where it makes sense to upstream to those guys, we want to do that, you know. I think just across the board, the intention with the next version of Opera, it's not to be like a skin on top of Chrome, but it's really to contribute to make it better and to push changes back so everyone wins. Mm-hmm. So actually, before I kind of segue into some other rambly thoughts, if anyone's listening and wants to move to Norway and work on the next version of Dragonfly, We're hiring for that. So
wow,
you can Google that or send me a message or whatever. But yeah,
that's a pretty developer-y dream job.
Hiring JavaScript engineers for dev tools.
It's just a sauna in every house. I mean, how do you not want that?
Yeah.
I don't even know.
Chris, you just moved to Wisconsin, but...
Summer is the nicest day of the year. It really is.
Yeah. I get it.
That was a joke, guys.
So you got a few more thoughts on all this? And then we got some questions for you.
Thanks,
but
Dave.
If there's any other interesting opera stuff we should know about?
Let me think. So Opera Mobile beta for Android. I think the final version is dropping soon. I don't know the exact date because I just read email and write code.
Does Presto live on and Presto live on in that, or is that also going?
So that's also Chromium based. Presto currently is still alive in our TV products. So I think that'll be the case for a while. If you thought when you heard about the Blink switch or the WebKit switch, like, oh, sweet, I'm going to go, delete all my dash O prefixes. That's probably, not the best use of your time. I don't know.
I guess for web developers or whatever, the switch to Blink means that Opera is just going to, it has a new kind of a standardized rendering engine. So like all those kind of edgy casey things should be kind of flattened out, but all the other stuff like JavaScript and network and all that, you guys can improve and do it different or better than Google or and stuff like that. Is that kind of the breakdown?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we can make changes to anything we want in the browser. Mm-hmm. We've added, for example, now it's kind of moot, but we had at supports enabled in our port, for a month or two before Blink decided to enable that. And we've added at viewport and stuff like that. So we can take the rendering engine and we can tweak it however we want, and we can hold on to our own patches and maintain those, or we can, hopefully right. The idea is really just to push that back to Google, especially for bug fixes and any kind of standards features. But JavaScript, so we're, the current plan is just to use V8. I'm not aware of any plans to develop our own or to extend that. I think right now everyone's focus is just like get the product shipped. I mean, there are a lot of really smart guys living in Sweden, Norway, and Poland who wrote Charakan in the previous JavaScript virtual machines. So, they might have some ideas. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Charakan is V8 of Opera.
Correct. Yeah.
Also being deprecated ish or whatever.
Well, cool. Well, we have actually a question kind of about rendering. So maybe we jump into the question and answer. Cool. Does that sound good?
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Jason Witt writes in, I have a question about responsive design using percentages for layout versus adaptive design using fixed widths for media queries. I really like responsive design, and I think it should be the way websites should be made, but Opera seems to have a problem with rendering percentages. For some reason, the percentages seem to render smaller than other browsers. This is forcing me to use adaptive design because I can't find a fix for Opera percentages issue. So what do you think is best to use right now? Responsive with percentages or adaptive with like pixel-based media queries? Ooh.
I feel like you guys could answer that question better. So the real question is, why is Opera whack with percentages?
Yeah, that's what the question is. And so the underlying question is that even true? Number one, is there some kind of like what if your percentage is 33.33333? Is there some rounding thing?
So
happens differently.
Yeah, I like this is such an unsatisfying answer for this guy's name, John Witt.
Jason
Witt. Sorry, Jason. I'd almost want to ask you, okay, what version are you using? Can you give me a test case to reproduce? I know we had a percentage rounding bug that really just frustrated a lot of Russians for years.
I think it's been fixed. Yeah, I was going to say, I think in my testing, like, it's gotten better. But at the same time, it's just kind of like the whole nature of the web is some stuff's different in different browsers. So I always just like ran with it and said, it'll fix up eventually. But
so what could be the possible problem with a rounding bug though? I mean, the worst thing that could happen is if you did like 33.33 and like 66.66 and something happened in which that if you're using floats, one would fall. I mean, that would suck if that actually happened.
But I think it was like subpixel rendering. So like kind of the old bug that like John Rezig wrote about in 2007. Like,
sure. So, but the end result of that, wouldn't that be like a little pixel that you could, like, if there's some different background colors going on, you could expose the pixel in between them or to the right or something. Wouldn't that be the worst possible?
Well, it's kind of like if you have 12 grid units or something.
Oh, it can compound. The problem gets worse as the more there are.
I'll just go ahead and answer the question. The answer is use whatever is cool. What's cool right now? Responsive design. Do that one. I mean, the real reason is because the problem will sort of solve itself, right? Like in a few weeks, months, or whenever Opera Desktop launches, you'll have the behavior that's basically Chrome's behavior, and you'll be good to go.
Well, and I think it's always like, I think do, like you said, do what's cool, or like do what you're trying to do.
Do the right thing.
And if it's a bug or it looks like it's a bug in a browser, then just file an issue.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
Does Opera accept public issues? They do, right.
Or send me an email, miket@opera.com, and I'll work it out.
Yeah. Cool.
That's a nice offer. It does seem a little extreme, Jason, just to think, oh, there's this little problem in Opera so I can't use responsive design at all. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't jump to a conclusion that far.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see what web page you were looking at when you wrote these words, because clearly it was like extremely frustrating and you were thinking about, you know, dropping the whole idea and taking a whole different approach to your web design, which seems like, you know, there must have been something going on. So I wish I could see what you could see when you were doing that. But if you still have that, make a test case, you know, CodePen's good for that. shoot it to Mike T. Anyway, let's do another one. How about that?
Yeah.
Devin Rahel. How was that? Rail?
Got it. Yeah, that's good.
Well, I was using some website, and it happened to be on opera.com. It was some kind of a marketing site, probably, that's not there anymore, so I won't even show you the URL, but where the primary scroll direction was to the right. You know, like most websites in the world, they expand down and you use your mouse or flick or whatever, and it moves down. But on this particular site, the scroll direction was to the right. And we've all seen that before, too, like slides and portfolio sites and stuff that try to be all fancy and move to the right instead. Wouldn't it be nice if you could change the scroll behavior of the spacebar? You know, like normally you hit the spacebar and it scrolls down, right? It's like the default browser behavior in most browsers, to change that and instead go right or left or up or whatever. You know, something about how that might screw some people up because it changes the default user experience. But, you know, what do you think about that? Is there a way to change that behavior? And what do we think about these, like, sites that scroll the unexpected way?
I'll do this in reverse question order. What do I think about sites that scroll the wrong way? They confuse me. They're neat. I don't know.
I mean, the fact that Opera did it doesn't necessarily have much meaning here, but you know, it's not something only for nerdy little portfolio sites. Clearly some very large sites on the internet have done it.
Yeah. But it does kind of break the expectation, right? If you're just used to being a keyboard navigator and slamming on the space bar to go down.
Yeah,
I don't know. Is that possible today to just listen to the space bar and cancel the default action and then just
that would be the question. Like, does prevent default work on a spacebar press?
Sure.
Like, yeah, probably it does?
Yeah, you can do that for all key presses. And then you would have to just...
Kind of not, right? Like, you can't override Command Q. It just won't let you. You know, there's something in the magical in the browser that just lets you not win that one.
Okay. I'm going to give the answer, try it and see.
Yeah, there you go. I would think that, like, it's not that bad. Like, what you're used to when you press the scroll bar, yes, is a scroll down.
Yeah.
But if you're on a website and you hit the scroll bar and it scrolled you to the right, it's not like you'd be like, oh my god, what's going on here? My life is over. You'd be like, oh, I see. This one scrolls to the right. It wouldn't be that big of a deal, would it? You know, it might be a little weird, but like, what you are used to is like it revealing more content for you.
Yeah. No,
it's not something that's going to like screw up.
It doesn't sound horrifying from like a user experience or whatever expectation perspective. Like, it makes sense. It's doing what it should be doing. It's just going the different way. And that shouldn't, you know, so the only other thing I'm thinking about space bars is if you reach the end of the page and you have a link element with the rel equals next in some browsers, if you hit space, it'll follow that link and go to the next page.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Rel next.
I mean, that works in Opera.
Oh man, remember when we used to use the rel attribute for just anything? I feel like before data attributes, right. You're like, just put it in the rel tag.
Rel bananas. What,
wasn't there that awesome one where it was like rel friend that you met in high school or something?
Oh yeah, it was supposed to be used for like your dating relationships essentially.
good stuff, semantic web.
The drunk days of semantic web.
Was that called Foth, friend of a friend? Or am I making that up?
I don't know about that one.
I remember it's this whole relationship module.
Yeah, know? It's all coming back. I think it was Tantec and Eric Meyer and
yeah, it's micro format-y stuff, right?
Good times.
With the idea that it was just like, if we did this and we did it in mass, then maybe search people would somehow then use this data somehow, maybe. Or somebody will write a JavaScript bookmarklet where you can click and it will make you an H card that you can then add to your local contact book that would have the right semantic information in it.
Oh, man.
It's a little pie in the sky.
You know what's weird is rel sister cousin wasn't one of the options.
That's,
Arkansas was like dying.
I mean, it was probably developed in California, so there's like rel equals au pair, right? And there's
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there a gender neutral? Oh, okay. I better shut up. Let's do a sponsor. Squarespace is one of the sponsors. I talked to a dude from Squarespace yesterday over Skype, Kevin Foley. What up, Kevin? He gave me a cool demo of some of the cool developer-y stuff you can do with Squarespace. So if you've never heard of Squarespace, let me just say quick that it's like basically a website for building websites. They have some templates and they're all like super nice. So if you go to Squarespace and you're just like, oh, you know, my the lady who cleans my house really wants to have a website for her business too. And she's always like, why are you always at home on your computer? I'm like, I'm a web designer. And she's like, I need a website. And you're like, I can't possibly help you with that. But I can give you squarespace.com where you could go and make your own website and have full control over it. That would be awesome. And of course, it's more than that. I Squarespace, don't be mad at me for telling you that it's a great place for house cleaning ladies to make websites, because it's for anything. Like if you're a photographer, it's particularly good. They have really good like media, like a band site would be pretty sweet on Squarespace. They're all responsive and look nice. They've released a couple themes lately that are pretty dang awesome, I think. And they have all kinds of features in them, like calendars. And, of course, you can blog and do all that type of stuff. But the developer stuff is interesting. So if you're a developer and you want to play around with Squarespace, number one, it's free. If you just want to like work on a Squarespace site, you can just do that for free and mess around with their dev tool stuff. And then if you want to deploy it later, then you can pay to do that. But if you just want to play around, you can do all that stuff for free. And they give you a Git repository. So you just like Git pull and then pull down your new site that you've just created. And it's really nice little organized repo. And then you just like set it up to like FTP your changes back up, and then you can in dev mode on Squarespace, you can like look at all the changes that you're making, and then when you're ready to push it out to your live site, then you know you get git commit and git push your the site, and then that takes it live. So it's a pretty cool little workflow. So check it out at developers.squarespace.com, or if you want to give Shop Talk show credit here, you go to squarespace.com/shoptalk, which like gives the cookie and stuff, so it seems like we're a good sponsor, which we clearly are. Okay.
There you go.
Ben Billups asks, I've noticed recently how fonts are displayed in different browsers, operating system, devices, whatever. For example, on the Amazon Silk browser, on the that's the browser that ships on the Kindle Fire, text on most websites is displayed with the irritating default browser fonts. Okay, so apparently there's some font on that comes that's baked into the Silk. So like it's not like if you just say display sans serif or font family sans serif or whatever, you like on Windows you get Arial, and on Macs you get Helvetica, and on Silk you get whatever their default font is. They probably have neither of those for whatever reason. But other websites display their custom fonts perfectly, and he was saying if I go to css-strix.com, the custom fonts look perfect there. So my question is, what's the best way to implement these fonts? Because there's clearly a right way and a wrong way and stuff. Just a glorified excuse to talk about font handling, I guess.
Font handling. I'll chime in with the only thing I'm qualified to talk about, which is not fonts. So if he's asking specifically about Amazon Silk, I don't know much about Silk, but it's a proxy browser, right? Or it can do kind of like a hybrid proxy mode. So
what does that mean exactly? Is like the cloud renders it and then it sends down a rendered version kind of deal?
Yeah, similar to what Opera Mini does, right? So in Opera Mini, you send a request which is routed through some servers which live in a volcano in Iceland and other places in the world. and the content is sent back not as is HTML over HTTP, but it's sent back as something called OBML.
And it's not even sent over HTTP. It's a different protocol even.
I meant the HTML part. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. I don't know. That's okay.
Right. So what you're getting back is some kind of magical PDF like image that's interactive. And so certain features, they just decide not to support because it's really expensive on the server side. You know, it's just not really worth it. So it could be, I mean, someone from Amazon let me know. It could be that they decide that for whatever reason, this font is just not worth sending back to the user when you're in your proxy mode. And instead it should, you know, render Jeff Bezos Family Sans Pro in its place. And then I'll leave the rest of the font discussion to use guys.
That would make sense if the font failed somehow,
right?
That it would just render some default thing instead. I guess I should do more browsing on that. I actually have a Kindle Fire, and I browse around on it once in a while, and I haven't noticed that it's like rejects custom fonts so much. So again, you got something, Dave.
Well, there's a bug, I think, with Silk that if you specify a local font in it, which you're like supposed to when you're doing your own font face embeds, you specify a local font, it's like, oh, yeah, local fonts, I got those. And it ignores the rest of like your declarations.
Okay. We should have asked so you first because.
I've worked on a site for a computer company out west. And, we ran into that. And so I would recommend you kind of have to like give Silk its own font face declaration. And the reason we're probably not getting dinged on it at Shop Talk and, probably your site, Chris, is, that we use font providers like Typekit or Google Web Fonts, which do that negotiation for you. When they serve you that little,
so there may be some behind the scenes sniffy sniffs going on.
Yeah, I think that, and yeah, like they do all the like behind the scenes.
Dirty work.
Yeah.
So, by local, you mean like in the, as part of the at font face like syntax? There's some way to like just to say what local one you want to try first, and if that fails, then that's what you mean, right?
Yeah, like. Yeah,
so grab it on the hard drive if you have it.
Yeah,
like the Paul Irish hack was like local smiley face to like ignore all local fonts or whatever.
Yeah.
Or you can do local Helvetica, and if it has Helvetica, it'll just use the local one, which is like the best way because then it doesn't download at all. But if you ever say local, I think this is what I'm recalling. Somebody can,
if you ever say local at all,
it's like, yeah. Yep, local. Doing it.
Right. And wasn't it WebKit based? But it was probably,
it's like, I think it's like Android, like crappy. Which was Android.crappy, whichever.
What's scary about browser land all of them?
Right.
Is that it takes a long time for a browser to get a really good update system in place, as we've learned with IE and stuff, you know, that only just very recently do they have any kind of system at all for updating a browser or keeping the users updated with that. You'd think that that's like the last concern, you know, like whatever I have on my Kindle Fire here, it's not like I'm going to pop up my Kindle Fire and be like, there's a new version of the Silk browser. Would you like to upgrade it or do it in the background or anything? No way. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that browser is just going to be around forever, which sucks.
Yeah. That would freak out people. Yeah. They just want to read a book.
Indeed. We got an audio one here from, Kevin Lamb.
Oh, yeah. Here, let me pull that up. Doop, doop, doop. I was totally unprepared. I'm changing my user agent to Silk to see if I can get this to work. Anyway, I'll stop. That's why you don't code while you're doing the show. Here we go.
Hi, Shop Talk. I'm a big fan of the show and love how you guys are able to explain complex topics in a very simple way. I've been learning JavaScript, and for some reason, I cannot get my head around closures. How would you explain closures to a six-year-old, and what situations would you use them in? Thank you.
How do you explain closures to a six-year-old?
There's pants and there's shirts. Pants go on your legs.
Go on.
Oh, closures. I get it.
Whoa.
Okay, so I have a 7-year-old, so I can try to explain from the perspective of a 7-year-old.
I think you should bring him in.
Oh, crap, he's at school. Be right back, guys. So a closure is a magical thing. Much like Harry Potter. Just kidding. He doesn't know about Harry Potter. Let me say when you might use... Forget the 7-year-olds. They're kind of weird. When you might use a closure. So I just used one recently, and it is to get a unique identifier for an object, right? Like a UUID. You've got some kind of object manager, and you need to make sure that one you grab is unique, and you need some kind of way to identify it as such. All right, so you can create a function, and I hope this doesn't blow your mind, but functions in JavaScript can return functions.
Yeah, that's the crux of a closure, I think, is a function within a function,
right?
Like a function factory.
Exactly, right? Exactly. A function bean observer singleton factory. Oh, wait, that's Java. So JavaScript, right? And the other trick to closures is... a variable that is defined in the outer scope, or let's say within that first function, the inner function can know that it exists and can read it.
Yep.
Even after that function has returned, which is kind of the special bit of magic. So if you imagine, I mean, I guess I could post a tweet, a gist of this actual example, so it's easier to see later. But you can imagine in your first function, you have a variable and it's just... let's just say it's I, or it's an index, right? It's the number 1. And in your inner function, it increments I, right? So if you call the first function, I feel like I've lost everyone. But if you call the first function, it's going to return this new function, which is able to update I. I is always different every time you call it.
So you've called your function factory once where I is 1. So right. What it returns is this function that increments I by 1.
Right. So next time you call that same function, it returns 2, and it returns 3 and 4.
So using your little function factory, now you have 2 copies of a function. One of them increments I by 1, and one of them increments I by 4 or something. Using this single function, you've created 2 functions that do different things. Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. So who said no? So when is that useful? It's, I mean, anytime you need to hold on to state kind of for your simple day-to-day, click on this button and do some Ajax, or do an animation, maybe not so useful. But when you're really dealing with multiple objects that need to know what's going on internally, it's very useful. It's a way you can kind of expose internal properties in a safe way.
Blah. That's interesting. I've never thought of using it as a state holder, but I guess that's probably the number one use case for it.
So at this point, my 7-year-old has left the room. yeah.
I was just reading up on it because I liked the idea that Kevin asked us here to explain it so simply, because you know, occasionally we can pull that off. I don't know how good at we are all the time. But I was like, you know, I'm not sure what that means exactly either. When I hear the word closure, I usually just think it of scope, you know, and just, okay, well, you know, and I was going to be like, okay, there's like a house, right? And there's a cabinet in the house. It's like, if I bring the apple in the house, the cabinet has access to it. But like, if I lived in the cabinet, I'm not able to access the apple because that's scoped the wrong way. I can't reach out of the cabinet to the house. It only works the other way. So that's you know, like a not great way of explaining scope, but okay. Maybe that's something. But then, you know, closures are actually more complicated than that. And actually on MDN, they have a little guide that explains kind of exactly what Mike, his example was with the little, you know, make incrementer kind of thing. They have a make adder function that is this little function factory that returns functions that do addition. And I clearly got it after I read this. Whether I'm able to explain it on the air, probably not. But I think if you read, and I'll put it in the show notes, if you just Google closures and find the one on MDN, it explains the concept pretty well. I wish it got a little more complicated, actually, because I like the idea of using it to save like widget state type of stuff, but I've never seen an example of that. So
there's actually an example. If you Google explain closures to a 6-year-old child, there's a nice story about a princess and a dragon and a unicorn.
Is there really?
Yeah. I just looked it up. So,
oh, there really is. Oh, that's amazing. I'll put that in the notes too.
There you go.
There you go.
Thanks.
Function princess var adventures null.
Oh, sad. Function princess has null adventures.
Well, she's fixing. It's fixing to happen. So function prince charming do something. Var unicorn var dragons. There we go. Return story function.
You know where you won't be snoring? At the Environments for Humans Conference, the CSS Summit. It's at cssummit.com. It's their 5th annual conference that's all about CSS. It's literally 3 days in a row. Dave is talking at it, so that's good enough reason to go for sure. If you decide you want to attend this, you can do it right from your chair. Use ShopTalk. Use the coupon code ShopTalk, the discount code ShopTalk, for 20% off the total price. So that's pretty sweet. 3 full days of just talking about CSS. I can tell you that my favorite conferences ever are the ones that are super specific. I think we even mentioned that jQuery conference earlier in the show. I look fondly upon that conference that I attended because it was so focused. It was so cool to be at somewhere where everybody's talking about the same thing. And this is just like that too, only you can attend it from anywhere in the world, which I'm sure is great for our international folks. I know a lot of times we talk about conferences that are in the US here, but you can definitely attend this from anywhere. Might be some time zone issues, but you'll be okay. And you can even buy a pass for your whole office to watch it, which I think is pretty cool. And I know we've talked about this plenty of times in the past, but like the conversation that happens during these are cool. So you like, you know, you bring up the conference in a web browser window that only you have access to, you know, there's like a code to get in and you just sit there in a chat room, and talk to other people about learning. And it's all, you know, the names at this thing are great. It's all the best people in CSS talking about CSS all day long. And you can pop in and out and stuff, you know, you don't have to comb your hair and stuff. Pretty good. So check out cssummit.com and go to it. Tell us how awesome it was. I'll be there chatting too.
I'm going to be there. Yeah. I'm talking.
Dave's talking at it.
About something.
Yep.
Speaking of CSS conferences, are any of you guys going to the CSS conf in what, like a week, 2 weeks?
Is that the Nicole one that's in
Florida?
JS Summit?
Yeah, like the JS Conf preamble.
I want to go so bad. I had 4 conferences in Florida this year, I think, and I was like, I can't go to Florida 5 times.
That's a lot of Florida. I mean, let's be honest. All right.
I wish I was going, but I'm afraid I'm not. Are you going to that one, Dave?
I'm not, but it looks good.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy for Nicole. It sold out super quickly, and it's good. Are you going what?
Oh,
Mike.
What? Sorry.
Are you going to it, or were you just asking us?
Yeah, just making chit chat.
Well, because you'll be at JSConf.
Yeah, probably, right? I'll be there. Nice. We're gonna road trip it, the whole fam. So, cool. If anyone who's listening is gonna be at CSSConf or JSConf, come say hi.
Nice. I would like to go to a JSConf someday, just because it's so elite. I desire to be among this elite crowd of people who are able to buy tickets on day one.
Yes. Pretty great stuff.
Well, thanks for CSS Summit for sponsoring CSSSummit.com. Mark Dixon asks, it is quite easy to set up caching of files when using htaccess. Just for reference, folks, he's talking about caching stuff like your JPEGs and stuff by adding a expires header to your htaccess file. That's what he's talking about. Telling the browser specifically, please hold on to this file. I don't intend to change it, and you can keep it in your cache. And the next time I ask for it, it will be in your local cache, and it will be very, very fast. But what about when you do frequent edits to like images or CSS files? You might add these expires headers to an image that you plan to update often or a CSS file that you're still working on. There are times when we want the browser specifically to download a new version of that file, but it has been cached on the server. What do you do then?
So the getaway to fix that is to use what we like to call a cache buster, right? Where you can just append a bogus get parameter to the request. And you can...
It looks like a different URL to the browser, and it's like, oh, I don't have this one in cache. This is a different file.
Exactly. So you can use your little closure that you made with Princess Bubblegum, and that returns a unique identifier. And so you can say... Git equals no cache 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. So each time it'll pull down the new guy. That's the ghetto way.
And it's ghetto, but it's also not ghetto. I mean, wouldn't be ghetto if it was part of your build process?
It works.
You know, like maybe.
No, that's basically like Rails does that by default, or it used to in Rails.
Yeah, it does. That's what I like. Yeah. I think that's a smart way to do it.
You know, you can append like a date time stamp to the end of it.
Sure. Or like your, you know, the commit unique git thing that it is or whatever. But what would be, I don't know, what are other ways then while we're talking about it? Maybe you just wouldn't send those headers while you're still working on stuff like that? Or
yeah, that was my thing, is like, are you just like hot editing on the server? Because that's what it sounds like, and you're running into a problem. I mean, ideally, like, you're deploying at an interval, you know, and your cache kind of matches that, but I don't know. I don't know. It sounds like
what I'm curious about is how does like something like Dragonfly enter the equation here? Can you tell Dragonfly to be like, just don't, I don't care what the headers of this file is, please go get it every time, or will it honor it, or is that a choice?
Yeah, so that's a feature we had for a very long time, and basically you have in the settings, you toggle a little switch that says, like, don't cache anything ever. And I believe that talks to the browser, you know, on the C++ side, and says, all right, just suck down everything you can. And Chrome DevTools added that not too long ago too. So if you hop into the settings, you can say like, don't cache junk.
Yeah.
It just says don't cache. I happen to know in Chrome, but is that really what it's doing, and how good does it work? I guess is the question. Presumably perfectly well. Or...
Always. Yes. Yeah. So, so there's that one quote, right? Like there's two hard problems in computer science, cache invalidation and something else, I have no idea. Right.
Naming things.
That, right? That sounds good.
Okay. We'll go. I like that we couldn't remember the name.
We're Grace Hopper over here.
Sorry, Martin Fowler.
Yeah, Martin Fowler.
Yeah, well, the reason you would want to do that maybe in DevTools is because there's something like a network timeline or whatever, which you won't, like, it will be weird if, like, half the stuff is cached. It's not giving you a really nice waterfall if half the stuff is cached, you know? It's like, I don't know. I guess that's why. And for reasons that, Mark, you're talking about, it's because you changed something and you want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, you have different environments, right? You have a development environment where you can deploy to, and so you're interacting with the server that mimics production but maybe has a different database, right? And then you would have, so you could turn off cache stuff there, and then maybe you have a staging environment where you just like push it as if it were production. You can do testing there, and then you push this junk to production. Perfect world, right?
Yeah.
Or something.
Well, hopefully that's useful to you, Mark. I would say the cache busting technique is the kind of the standard op way.
Cache busting with the timestamp or renaming your file, like adding an MD5 hash into your file or something.
Yeah.
That's other things.
Don't do it randomly. I've seen that like people do that in production, which I think is so crazy. They're like, just put a date stamp at the end of it. You're like, oh, whoa. Don't do that.
It's like,
to make sure that your cache never works. I mean, cache is what makes websites fast.
It's like when I was writing my master's thesis, it's like final version 1.final/actually final .doc.
Oh, boy. All right. So next.
Last question. One.
Last one. It's an audio question. My favorite kind of question here at the Shop Talk Show.
Hi, Chris and Dave. This is Ryan Burnett. I'm a front-end developer who has a local workflow. I compile SAS, compile JavaScript, work locally, and then commit my projects to a repository like GitHub. That helps me get more work done, helps me collaborate with teammates, and I really like this flow. I've completely divorced editors like Coda, and I don't like to edit files live on the server. But I'm running a situation where I'm working with an app that has to post data to a remote endpoint and then receive post data back. And I don't see any choice other than to work on that on the server. And I'm wondering if there's something else I should be doing, because it's bringing up those old problems again, like losing files when the FTP transfer doesn't work right and me and teammates stepping on each other's toes. I was just wondering if there's something else I should be doing, or if I'm just stuck with reverting back to the old workflow in this situation. I appreciate your thoughts. Thanks.
So, interesting problem. How do you test post requests from third parties locally? Like, say, I think his example was you posted a file or something like that, and then something processes and then sends a post back to your site, and then you respond to that post.
Well, the post, it would have to be not your own server, right? Otherwise, it would work fine, right? It's like the question is, you have like, you know, mysite.dev, which is not accessible from the internet, and then you're like working with PayPal or something, or authorize.net, and it's like a payment was made. Even if you're in their sandbox mode and you're getting a fake post because you're trying to test it, you can't go into their settings and be like, oh, just send that post request back to mysite.dev, because it just won't, you won't get it, you know.
Mike, do you do any of this stuff?
No, I despise third parties. Just kidding, I love them. I'm just trying to think what you could do. I mean, I don't know if it's possible to forward your ports on your router to your local server. Intercept that junk that way. I mean, yeah, I'm not.
That's clever.
I'm not really familiar with the problem of having to interact with this stuff. So I'm
surely there's like what are you expecting back, right? Like some like post data. But it's probably pretty guessable what it is you're going to be, or get it once and then save it. Like what, it's like a bit of JSON, or it's, you know, it's just post data, and then just fake it somehow. You know, just fake it locally.
So actually, in the chat, this cool guy, Boris Court, he just had a really neat idea. He said, git push to something like a Heroku staging. So you could actually set something up like a post commit hook. So when you push to GitHub, Git could automatically, so it'll push it to GitHub, and then you can have another remote, which is Heroku, which is kind of mimicking your environment, and that's a real server, and it can mm-hmm. talk back and forth. He's a pretty cool dude, so try that.
It sounds like staging has to be involved somewhere. Yeah. You know? I mean, if you take the example of PayPal, that's probably the best one, right? Because, like, you filled out a form, you sent that form data to PayPal. PayPal takes the money, sends money back to you, basically. You want that. How do you test that? I mean, PayPal has that sandbox, so that's kind of part of, like, how they operate. Gosh, yeah, I think you'd have to have some sort of staging set up for your app, definitely, but then maybe even something that fakes a
I guess it's supposed for testing, but there's got to be some pretty simple way to grab that post data once and then make some little URL on your site that has a form on it that you can submit, or that just by going to that URL automatically and just fakes it.
Yeah, fakes.
I mean, I just Googled, like, fake post requests locally, and there's a little gem called Fake Web that does it in Ruby, you know.
Yeah.
And you could just, you know, just post in PHP, just, you could curl a dude. I don't know. I like the idea of trying to do it live, though, because, you know, faking it is fine, but there is something to be said about the unpredictability of the actual third party.
Yeah, that's the big thing, huh?
Right. So the Heroku idea is pretty cool. All right. Can we gotta leave it? I feel like we pittered out. Can we do a fake question? Some enthusiasm?
Fake. Mike.
Yo.
Where will Opera be in 20 years?
Oh, great.
We're going to be really into, like, connected window advertising mm-hmm. stuff. I have no idea.
But on the moon.
Yeah. We'll still be in Norway.
Norway, the moon.
Yes. After we colonize the
Norway moon.
Conquer the moon Vikings.
That's good. That's good. Chris, CodePen, 20 years.
Moon. Something moon based. Moon based. I don't know.
Moon based development.
Anyway, thanks for being on, Mike. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Had a ton of fun.
Dave.
How can people follow you on Twitters and give you money, Mike? How's that work?
So if you want to send me money, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to 3003 East 18th and a half, Austin, Texas, 78702, and I'll send you back a thank you card. You want to follow me on Twitter? It's
at. That's the first time we've got a home address. But.
Come on by. I've got co-working hours. Not really. Please don't. Mike Taylor on Twitter without the O because of it was taken. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
That follows you around. You're Mike Taylor without the O. In various configurations.
Yeah, it's a problem that people like me have with very common names. Yeah. Yeah,
indeed.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and teaching us all about browsers and educating us a little bit, because Lord knows we could use some education. And thanks everyone for coming out in the chat room. You guys are the best, always giving us facts as well. And follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Raise up in iTunes or whatever you use for podcasting these days. And Chris?
ShopTalkShow.com.
Ta-da!